Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Alex Hay about his historical novel, The Housekeepers. Alex grew up in Cambridge and Cardiff and has been writing as long as he can remember. He studied history at the University of York and wrote his dissertation on female power at royal courts, combing the archives for every scrap of drama and skullduggery he could find. He's worked in magazine publishing and the charity sector and lives with his husband in London. The Housekeepers is his debut novel and won the Caledonia Novel Award. In this episode, we discuss creating an ensemble cast of characters, how it took a clear idea and a story that felt fun and more him to attract an agent, and how this novel turned him into a mega planner. But before all that, here's Alex with an excerpt from The Housekeepers.
Mrs. King laid out all the knives on the kitchen table. She didn't do it to frighten Mr. Shepherd, although she knew he would be frightened, but just to make the point. She kept good knives. She took excellent care of them. This was her kitchen. They had scrubbed the room to within an inch of its life, as if to prevent contamination. The tabletop was still damp. She could feel the house straining, a mountain of marble and iron and glass, pipes shuddering overhead. She reckoned she had 20 minutes until they threw her out. Madam was awake and on the prowl, up in the vast ivory stillness of the bedroom floor, and they were already late with breakfast. It was important that Mrs. King didn't waste time or endanger anyone else. She didn't care what they did to her, she was past caring about that, but troubles had a way of multiplying, sending out tendrils, catching other people. She moved fast, going from drawer to drawer, checking, rummaging. She was looking for a wrinkle in things, a missing piece, something out of place. But everything was in perfect order. Too perfect, she thought, skin prickling. A shadow fell across the wall. I'll need your keys, please, Mrs. King. She could smell Mr. Shepherd standing behind her. It was the odour that came off his skin, the fried-up scent of grease and gentleman's musk. Breathe, she told herself. She turned to face him.
Hi, Alex. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Housekeepers.
Chloe, thank you so much for having me. I am beyond thrilled. I've been listening to the podcast since episode one, so this is a very full circle moment. Very exciting.
Oh, it's so lovely. I feel like so super embarrassed, but also so happy that you've said that. That's so lovely. Thank you. I'd love if you could start by introducing The Housekeepers to us. Tell us what it's all about.
With great pleasure. So The Housekeepers is a historical heist, and it's set in London in the summer of 1905 and tells the story of Mrs. King, who is a very charismatic, sharp-witted, cool-headed housekeeper to one of the grandest mansions in Mayfair. But when she is unfairly dismissed after many years of loyal service, she decides she's going to enact her revenge by carrying out the most audacious robbery that high society has ever seen on the night of the grandest ball of the season. So think big hats, big houses, bad men, brilliant women, and if you cross the Oceans franchise with Upstairs, Downstairs, then you're halfway there.
That is one hell of a pitch delivered perfectly. I can tell you've been practicing that to a T.
Thank you so much.
So I'm interested to know kind of what came first, really. Was it, I mean, I know you studied history at university and you've obviously got a real passion for historical fiction and that kind of era of writing, but you also, I know, love kind of the fun of the heist. So where did it all begin?
Yeah, you're quite right. I was a history student, but that feels like a gazillion years ago. And truthfully, the starting point for this book was I'd been itching to write a heist because the plot structure just felt like such a gift to a writer because it's got such clear movements. You've got the section of gathering a team, you unveil a plan, you throw as many obstacles as you can at the gang along the way, and then you try and pull off plenty of surprises and glittering excitement at the end. And all of that just felt like fun. And candidly, I'd written many books over the years, sitting in drawers that were not very fun. They were pretty dour. And I just thought, I really, really want to have a plot structure that has a really good, clear goal, that can give my protagonist something very straightforward and shiny to aim for, which I think had been a bit of a pitfall in past books of mine, that my protagonist sort of meandered around the story until they sort of gently limped over the finishing line. So that was the sort of first quite straightforward thought in my mind was let's get a big, shiny, juicy plot structure going. And then secondly, I'd always been longing to set a book in the 1900s because it's the most delicious, opulent time. And I think, the brand of the Edwardian period, which certainly I had in my mind, of broad-brimmed hats and rolling lawns and armies of servants felt very appealing to use as a setting for this type of story. And I'd been reading a book which I absolutely adored called The Lost Mansions of Mayfair, which listed in absolutely exquisite detail some of the most opulent and wonderful mansions once scattered all over West London. And I just thought, oh, those houses are going to be ideal to set a sort of big shiny robbery. So effectively gluing setting and plot structure together was the starting point. And then it was a case of sort of pondering, okay, who's my cast and how can I get them up and running?
I'll touch on that in a second, but I just want to go back to, all those poor dour novels that have, haven't seen the light of day. Were they finished? Were they unfinished? Like, what? How do you kind of, how do you attempted to kind of get to the point where you were sending out novels to agents before, or was this your kind of, this was the one, or what was the kind of, what was the kind of experience there that you had?
Well, I mean, I have been writing as long as I can remember. So there's, all the madcap gothic novels written in my teens. Then there's the long hiatus at university where I wrote nothing and read nothing, and then came back to writing in my 20s. And in my late 20s, I guess I got serious about it. So I went on a Curtis Brown Creative course. And on that course, I was writing a sort of historical speculative novel, which didn't really go anywhere. But I did send it out to agents and I did get a couple of requests for the full. But I sort of felt that from a genre perspective, it fell between two stools and I wasn't really going to be able to get it up and running. So I parked it. I'd moved on to a more straightforward historical novel with a sort of supernatural tint to it. And again, sent that out to agents and actually got a few more requests for the full that time. And it's sort of the classic story. The responses started to be a bit warmer. So I went, okay, I'm, getting onto something here. Started another couple of books, but abandoned those at the sort of 25, 30,000 word mark, mainly because I wrote them without plan and they just fell over immediately. Wrote something else, which I did finish the first draft of, but thought, I don't know this, I don't actually want to send this out. And then in the summer of 2020, sort of lit on the idea of the housekeepers. So I suppose by that point, I'd learned a lot about my own capability or lack thereof in terms of writing. I'd started to get a sense that I needed to be quite clear in the proposition if I wanted to get agent representation, because I was sort of getting closer, but not quite over the line. But I also recognize that I just wanted to enjoy the process a bit more and maybe try and write something that felt more organic and more me, and take everything I'd learned and just really throw everything at it. And that was the experience of writing The Housekeepers. Once I lit on that plot meets setting idea, I just had that sort of tingle of I am going to love writing this so much. And if I can pull it off, then I think I could get an agent. So then it was a sort of case of, okay, right, no pressure. Let's see if I can make this happen.
Mm. The reason I asked that is also because I think from a lot of people's perspective, and we all know that many of us, you know, have loved writing our whole lives and we've worked away on various bits and pieces. But on the outside, it always looks like you've written one book and that's the one you've decided to go with and it's become a success and you've got a book deal and blah, blah, blah. Often there's way more backstory to it. You've written other novels that haven't worked, or they have worked, but they're not quite right. Or you have had agent attention. You know, I've had guests on the podcast that have had, you know, seven attempts at submissions and they haven't worked. So I think it's interesting when we look at kind of what a debut novelist is, that there's a lot more work you've put into it than just that one novel.
I know, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I don't know whether you're supposed to admit you've got all these other books sitting in yours, whether it.
Oh yeah, that's just, you know, if we all do. I mean, there's probably hundreds of started and not finished things on my computer that I don't even want to look at.
and I think that's part of the apprenticeship, isn't it? You've got to go through your hours, your years of trying and learning and crafting the process. But I can see that appealing idea of being a debut, quote unquote, who doesn't have that sort of backlog of books in drawers. And actually, I do know people whose first finished work of fiction did get picked up by an agent and did get published, and it is absolutely terrific. So it can be done. I am glad actually that wasn't my journey, because I think I would, knowing myself, I think I would be so utterly petrified I would not be able to write another word, let alone another book ever again. I'm sort of glad I learned, I suppose, the stamina, I suppose, just to keep going and keep sort of churning books out and hoping and praying. And you will know this, it's just the sort of faith you have, that it's all going to come off in the end. And that's sort of what keeps powering you on, even on those sort of weekends when you're not leaving the house and the parties you're not going to and the stuff you're not doing, because you're just giving up hours and hours and hours of your time around work and around life and everything else. You've got to sort of just keep pushing through, but I prefer that journey, actually. I think that's probably strengthened me as a writer. But yeah, it's a funny one. Debut doesn't always necessarily capture that pathway.
Yeah, definitely. So let's touch back on your brilliant cast of characters then, your fantastic group of women who take part in this heist. Obviously, Mrs. King is at the heart of it, but I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about how you brought your characters together and how do you kind of created all their different personalities and decided who is going to have what skill to be crucial in this operation.
Yeah, well, this is an ensemble cast. It's a pretty big cast. And actually, in the first draft, it was even bigger. So, you know, Lord help us if there are too many characters in it at the moment. It was even worse. I suppose the starting point was picturing this cast of servants sidling out from behind the Green Bay's door underneath a very elegant staircase in this beautiful mansion in Park Lane, and considering what different roles they would have. But you asked a really astute question there, which is what skills do they each need to have? So obviously a big job like this is going to need to be financed. You're going to need to have somebody who understands the house and its schematics. You're going to have to, in this particular story, have some people with a particularly remarkable skill at the trapeze, because it is no mean feat to strip the grandest mansion in Mayfair of all its costly treasures on the night of a very large party. So sort of thinking through the practicalities of what might be required was I suppose sort of a quite straightforward process. And then the first draft meant that those characters were actually a little bit thin, sort of did what I told them to do for the sake of the plot, but the emotional motivation of what they were doing it for was perhaps not fully there. And I suppose in the course of rewriting the book, it was a case of trying to peel back their layers and get a bit closer to the bone. So, I mean, on the subject of Bones, Mrs. Bone, who is the financial backer of this enterprise, is a pretty, I say she's bombastic in bombazine. She's a pretty tough character who is a black market entrepreneur who has made a pretty tidy fortune from businesses, both legitimate and not so legitimate, and has a very personal connection to this house on Park Lane and goes incognito into the house to play the lowliest servant in the entire building, which was delicious for me because I could torture Mrs. Bone, put her in all sorts of degrading and infuriating positions while she was seeking and sourcing information, which was quite fun. But actually, in the course of rewriting her and trying to understand what those secret connections and secret dynamics might be and how they might play out, and indeed, as the plot unfolded, how they might send her in interesting directions that went off plan. That was all really fun detective work for me as the author. And actually, I would say each of those key characters all had a little bit of that journey to them. So it was just I suppose a case of peeling back their layers and then trying to set them up and running on the page and running at each other too, so that I could really maximize the tension in the book and lift the stakes to give the reader a sense that actually they as a group, while closely united, could equally fall apart at any moment.
And you mentioned that you kind of one of the appealing aspects of choosing a heist story is the structure. And I wondered whether, I mean, you I kind of hinted maybe that you are quite a planner. Did this make the kind of construction of your own heist in the novel easier because you had that kind of structure already, or did you really have to really stretch yourself and your writing skills to kind of come up with all the stages, the twists, and all the things like that.
Yeah, I was a mega planner with this book because I really loved the idea. And I just thought, if I don't plan this to within an inch of its life, I'll let myself down and the whole story will fall over. So I got out a pretty gargantuan spreadsheet. And for the geeks among us, I was relying on good old Save the Cat, looking at heist beats. I mapped those onto a spreadsheet and then started setting out the different individual scenes that would sort of align to those chunks of the book, and brainstormed what's the most exciting, interesting, daredevil thing that could happen at each of these stages. And that meant that actually some of my research was quite planned as well and quite pragmatic. So I would say, for example, right, I think I'm at this point, need to get everybody out of the house. I'm going to need to have some sort of device that's going to need to make that happen. So my research task is go find bonkers slash exciting Victorian or Edwardian invention that could be sufficiently powerful to get an entire cast of characters to run from a house into the street. And thus I would go do that particular piece of research. And sometimes I would find the answer and sometimes I wouldn't. And actually, once I built that plan, writing the first draft came quite quickly because I'd laid out all those sort of bare bones. But inevitably, of course, I read back the first draft and it was absolutely full of plot holes. I mean, I had people just sort of standing by drain pipes for days at a time, waiting for deliveries. The timeline was completely off. One minute a room was on the ground floor, the next minute it was basically in the attic. It was all over the place. So much for planning. And actually, some of the things that held together the most in the end probably were just sitting in my head. For example, I never had a map. I never drew one. I sort of felt as though I took a risk. I felt as though I had enough in my mind. I could picture the house strongly enough in my mind to make sure that it was all going to work. And as we were sort of approaching publication, my publishers said, "Do you have the floor plan? Because we'd love to sort of make one for the end papers of the book." And I was like, "End papers? How delicious! Yes, please!" And then I panicked immediately because I was like, "No, I don't have a floor plan." And if anyone actually looks at this and then checks the text, what if it's all over the place? So I had to do quite a lot of going back over that spreadsheet to work out, okay, where did I say each room was in what order, and how am I going to draw this on a piece of paper to make sure it could all be printed? So this is a roundabout way of saying, yes, I planned and planned and planned. And then I didn't plan what I should have done and gave myself quite a lot of pickles, and then had to rewrite immensely by the way. So, I sort of wonder whether I needed to do that much on Excel in the first place.
So now you're basically saying if someone has got a copy of the end papers, don't go and check which cross-references the text just in case there are any errors that you've made.
No, do cross-reference it and then let me know. I really did my very, very utmost to try and make sure it was all right. And luckily I'd really spent so much time envisioning this house and thinking through the sort of gorgeous detail of the rooms, the sweep of the stairs, the positioning of the ballroom, the winter garden, the saloon, the smoking rooms, the oval drawing room, the boiserie, the sight lines to the park. I really had spent a lot of time visualising all of that. And luckily, a lot of that held firm. I did make a couple of adjustments along the way and sort of moved some walls around, moved some trees around, just to help myself out as the author. And that was the stuff I had to go back and be like, oh, hang on, what did I commit or not commit myself to? But yeah, all of that sort of designing the heist and designing what was going to need to complicate it, that was really fun, but also just a massive head scratcher to put together. And I was itching always just to dive into, just start the draft. And but I kept pulling myself back to go, no, plan it, try your best to get it right.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it did help you in the long run. I mean, you say a lot changed, but I think if you hadn't have planned it, then you would have, can you imagine the work then? It would have just been awful.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a disaster. Yeah, you're quite right.
Plot holes would be, plot craters, I think. If
yes.
If you'd done that.
They would be.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
When you talk about your research, I can just feel, and through your writing, I feel like your passion for the house and for the era. And I always think this about historical fiction writers, like, what is that point then when you think, okay, I've done enough research now, I'm just going to put the books away or put the internet away and just go and write? And I know you mentioned about kind of dipping back in to kind of find the answer to a question, but you know, how long do you have to start searching? What if you've done 4 hours and you haven't found that bit of research? What do you do then?
I mean, that's a good question. I'm quite tough with myself because I feel like if I'm wasting time, I start to feel quite guilty. And you get that kind of ick feeling of this was an hour or half hour where I could have got my workout up, and I've just actually spent the time looking at what Mrs. Beaton's advice for cleaning picture frames is. However, sometimes those little nuggets are incredibly useful. So, you know, it's not always wasted. And, you know, I'm writing in this period because I love that process and love pulling out all those delicious details. So I suppose my approach for this book was that I'd read around the era quite a lot already. And some of that detail I'd gathered by osmosis over the years. But I did also recognise that my teenage binging on reruns of Upstairs, Downstairs was probably not the most robust research I could have done. And particularly once you start scratching at the surface of the 1900s, it doesn't take long for you to see that not all that glitters is gold. And there was gargantuan levels of corruption existing not far beneath the surface. And that was really where I had to do more thoughtful research and reading, particularly on the darker side of the service trade, and to try and really build my own understanding of the risks that were faced by servants, the exploitation that was faced by them, particularly by young women in the service trade, and think thoughtfully about how to feed that into the plot. So I suppose there was some quite big meaty stuff that felt important to get right. And I suppose then my test was just, do I feel I've read enough that this feels as though it's broadly right for the book? And that's just instinct. Then on a sort of lighter note, the fun stuff, that was just self-discipline to be like, right, there are no more examples of hats made in New York and shipped over to London with big ribbons that you need to look at for this page. So it's time to move on. The thing that was actually, the stuff I would always keep going and going on was for food. I just love all that ridiculous, big, high Victorian Edwardian food, all those jellies and bits of tongue, which sort of make me feel sick, but it's so satisfying to go through all menus and just sort of concoct these absolute feasts that my characters would indulge themselves in. So that I could have done forever, but had to sort of at some point go, right, you have enough, you've got a word count to hit, otherwise this book is never going to get done and you've got to go to work, so let's go.
You mentioned as well that kind of having that kind of intuition and that gut feeling. Was it the same for the book as a whole? Was there a moment as you were writing, or whether you were, I don't know, 40k through or 50k through, that you were like, I've got something special here, this is working, it's feeling good, I'm feeling good? Did you have that moment?
I'd often heard people say that if you describe the idea to other people and they go, ooh, you know you've got something. And I had that from day one. So I remember telling my husband that this was what I was thinking of doing. He was like, oh, that's good, actually, you should do that. And then telling a friend and her saying, oh, I love that, that's really good. And that was a sort of moment for me, a sort of litmus test of people get it. I think for me, I had that then from day one. But the moment, I suppose just the moment I started writing, maybe chapter 3, when I have Mrs. King, my protagonist, meeting her slightly shady associates, I just thought, oh, this is really, really, really joyful to write. I'm really enjoying their dynamics. I'm enjoying her. This is the first really tough protagonist I've written who is just going to slice through both this house and this world. And I can really get on her coattails and just enjoy the ride. And that felt like a real shift for me because, as I mentioned before, I'd had characters who had that classic problem of just being too passive. So that was a sort of craft change for me that I felt as though I've got a protagonist here I can really work with. And then as the cast built, I just thought, finally, I've got people who can make jokes and be fun. And so that was the moment when I just felt like the story was sort of lifting off for me. But you never know, do you? You sort of just, I don't know if you ever have this, but you have to get through a first draft, tell yourself, this is a work of absolute genius and yay for me. And then you obviously in the next moment tell yourself that it's absolutely diabolical, no one's ever going to enjoy it, it makes no sense, and you don't have the ability to write a complicated plot at all. And I definitely am that author, like highs and lows,
yeah,
all the way through every draft.
it can change, you know, morning, afternoon. Morning, it's this is amazing. I'm writing great stuff. And then you look at it in the afternoon and you're like, what is this?
Yeah, totally.
So I know you did you did a CBC course, mm-hmm. and you were also longlisted for the Caledonia Novel Award in 2022. How did these two things kind of boost you as a writer, lift you, and give you that kind of confidence in yourself?
Well, CBC, Curtis Brown Creative, that was really transformative for me. And I can see the sort of trajectory I went on in terms of how I spent my writing time and how I thought about it. I can really see a shift from being on that course. So I was on that course back in 2015, and I was just really excited to get on it. I mean, at that stage, I knew it as the place that Jesse Burton had been. I remember doing my application and just being like, I don't know if I'm going to get on, and getting the message actually saying you've been accepted was mega. And I don't think anything has been as scary in the publishing journey at any point as the first time I gave the opening chapters of that book in to be read by the other 14 people in that class. And I remember I was the first person, I think, to get feedback in our very first session. So none of us really knew what the dynamic was going to be like.
Mm.
And we were tutored by Erin Kelly, who is just phenomenal. Yeah, she's just, I mean, so, so incredibly kind and astute. And she sort of intuited from that first session what I was trying to do, what my style was. So that was just an incredible feeling of fellowship with other writers that I really trusted and formed, you know, genuine friendship and community with. And I've heard a lot of people who've been on courses say that. So I think that was really pivotal. And I think what that taught me was that, you know, this is a business. You've got to have a clear pitch. You've got to have a clear proposition. And naively, I thought I did have those things. I was like, this is great. I'm going to be agented in like 5 minutes. Woo! And of course, that did not happen. And I didn't get agented on that book or the next one or the one after that. And that was a useful lesson as well, that you just have to have resilience and just keep going. So I suppose CBC just sort of made me feel professional. And it also set the goal in my mind, because I could see other people on my course as well who were just having phenomenal success.
Mm.
And, you know, it was nice actually that I never felt envious or jealous of anybody in the class. Always, always super, super happy for anybody's success, but really motivated by it. Competitive in like a really, I hope, healthy way. So that was all fantastic. And then writing competitions. I mean, again, I'd seen people just have absolutely terrific success from them. And I was like, oh, I want a little bit of that. So I entered loads and loads of competitions with loads of, you know, partial manuscripts, fulls over the years, never longlisted for anything. And I almost didn't enter the Housekeepers for the Caledonia Novel Award, because I'd entered before and I hadn't got through that first hurdle. But I thought, I'll just give it a go. And the sort of primary reason was that the judging agent was Alice Lutyens that year. And I wasn't sure whether she was looking for historical, because her bio on the Curtis Brown website at that time, I think, was ambiguous. And I was like, oh, I don't quite know if I can submit to or not. So I'm just going to throw myself in the competition and see what happens. And I'm so glad I did, because, you know, the Caledonia Novel Award is an amazing award. It's really well run. It's got a fantastic community around it. It's got a really good reputation. And being longlisted was just a sort of night and day moment in the whole process for me, because suddenly, you know, the book started getting full requests. It was out on submission to agents anyway, but being able to sort of follow up with everybody and sort of share the news that it was on the long list and that I'd started to get full manuscript requests just sort of accelerated things so, so much. So I really, you know, I really thank that prize for just helping to turbocharge things in a way I don't think it would have done otherwise.
Mm. And then, of course, you signed with Alice.
Yay. Yes, I did. Yeah. So that was an amazing moment. I mean, I don't know about you, but for me, being signed by an agent always felt like the biggest door to try and open. But like, if you had somebody who could be your business partner in your career, who could give you sage advice, and who would fundamentally be the person who could open the critical doors to publishers, that you would just be so much further along the journey. And I'd heard authors over the years say, you know, even talking to friends and family, once you said you were represented, everyone just sort of sits up and takes you seriously. And of course you shouldn't crave that, but if I'm, you know, being totally honest, that felt really important. It was sort of a validation of everything. So I was really, really happy when the Caledonia Novel Award ended, that Alice was able to offer me representation, and I wasn't sure whether she would. And it was a really, really special moment because she set out an absolutely phenomenal editorial letter for me saying, this is everything I love. This is everything I think you need to work on. I'm completely straightforward. I am no BS at every stage. I don't get this, or this from your book, and you sort it out. And it was fantastic. And it was said with love and kindness and also a sense of energy and motivation that she was going to deliver a kind of level of editorial scrutiny. That was exactly what I was looking for. I'd always known I want to have an agent who's editorially hands-on. I need it. That lift that Alice's edits gave the book was I think a key part of why we got a deal. But we had to work really fast because the competition had just ended. We knew there was some interest or engagement around that. Alice's line to me was absolutely clear. If the book is ready to go, I will take it out. If it's not, I absolutely won't. So it's over to you, because this is a golden opportunity and you cannot mess it up. And you also just can't take the book out before it's ready, because if you don't get some interest, then it's going to be quite hard to sell it later on. So she was just very, very pragmatic with me at every stage, which was brilliant, because then I was like, right, my mission is to write like a loon. And so I did, and exhausted myself and got a couple of round of edits done at high speed with Alice. But I'll be forever grateful for that care and time she put into just making sure we punched the book up as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I know it makes some writers nervous to work with agents and editors, because they feel like, you know, you just have to say yes to everything and, you know, it's not your book anymore and people will change things that you don't want to change. But there's nothing I enjoy more than working on something editorially and discussing things and, you know, really debating things and going, well, why would this character do this? And you're defending it, and then your editor or your agent is coming back going, but it doesn't work this way. Maybe try this way. And that's such a great part of the whole writing process, I think, anyway.
I agree. I mean, I love it. I love the debates. It feels really intellectually engaging and exciting. And, you know, the old truism that someone can tell you what's wrong, but only you can find the solution, I think is true. Because some suggestions are absolutely sparkling and miraculous, and you go, of course, that's the greatest idea I've ever heard. And others, you just sort of know in your gut, oh, I see why you're suggesting it, but it's not quite right. How about X, Y, Z? And I loved that. And I think actually, I sort of reflecting on it, I think I felt quite safe quite quickly with Alice. I knew that her story instincts were aligned to mine.
Mm.
I knew she curated her list quite carefully, and I really admired who was on there. And I felt she was focused on, we want to make sure the prose is polished and clean and lean, but I need the word count right. I need the structure right, and I need everything to land the way it needs to land. And I really liked that, because it just made me sort of lift my skill quite fast, but sort of learn and debate and ask questions of her and seek her instincts along the way. So I'm with you. I think, you know, what is better than that? And then, of course, got to do it again with phenomenal editors at the publishing house, which was again miraculous.
Yeah, so you've got your book deal, and now I'm dying to talk to you about this aspect of it, because I mean, I know social media isn't the whole experience, but judging from your social media, you've had an amazing time kind of publicizing your book, going and doing proof drops. You've done loads of events already. What has it all been like? How have you found that experience as a new author?
It's been very special. And I sort of knew what a dreamy debut experience could look and feel like, because let's be honest, I've been stalking everybody on Twitter for years myself. So I was really, really, really happy when we got the deal. And I was just thrilled to know that there was going to be, or sense that there was going to be, a good level of support within Headline for the book. And again, being candid, it's not lost on me that not all books can get that, and you won't get that forever. And if you're lucky enough to get another deal in the future, it could be a very different scenario for all the right reasons, which is that, you know, publishing house has to really think very carefully about where it's putting its energy. So I felt, you know, hugely excited by all of that. Being totally honest with you, I did also go slightly mad. I think last autumn, when we started sending the proofs out to the first early readers, I just got very, very anxious. And I didn't get anxious about the book being despised or people hating it or bad reviews. I just got anxious about everything else in my life. And at the time, I was like, I don't know why I'm such a mess. And of course, now I realize, looking back, I'm like, well, it's probably because it's quite a vulnerable position to put yourself in to send something out into the world. But I couldn't quite correlate the two because I felt really lucky. And that was a really interesting lesson, that you can get what you've been dreaming of, which is the deal. But then there's the sort of journey that follows that, which is you then have to crack on with doing what you want to be doing, which is writing the next book and improving your craft, and try to be relaxed about the fact that some people will like it, some people won't. And that's okay. And actually, I would say once we first started getting reviews in, I felt a bit weird about it at first, because I got some really lovely ones, which were very, very pleasing. And then I got some negative ones, which knocked me a little bit. But I got over that quite fast, actually. Because I think I got everything from 1 to 5 stars really quite quickly. I sort of saw the whole gamut and therefore was like, right, I don't need to look at these anymore. And that was useful, actually. And a couple of months ago, I was chatting to another writer and saying, I think I'm in quite a healthy place now where I don't worry too much about those reader reviews from a sort of personal perspective, but I find it really interesting. And I go on and, you know, occasionally scan literally everything and see what I can learn out of it. And I don't quite know what I do with that information at the moment. Let's wait and see. But it just doesn't sort of bruise me in the way that perhaps I feared it would. So I suppose the whole journey has been just a process of realizing that at the end of the day, you're in this because you want to get better at writing and crafting really good stories, and you're still on that journey. And actually, the apprenticeship is not over. And I'm pleased and grateful that this book got a deal and it's out in the world. And I'm so, so happy. I cannot tell you that people have enjoyed it. But I feel like I'm only just beginning and I've got to learn how to do all this again. So I suppose that's the thought that sort of ended up uppermost in my mind. But, oh, Chloe, it took many months to get there.
Well, at least you had fun while you were doing it, even if yes. It was a slightly mad experience. I think, it's not a normal everyday thing to, you know, you half feel like a celebrity and then you half just feel like you're back at home feeling completely worthless about what you're writing, and you're just like, oh. And it's just the two complete opposite worlds, I suppose, that makes it so difficult to deal with. Normally, yeah. I would say, you know, what kind of advice would you give to the next cohort? But I kind of think that you've covered what it's like in your experience there of being a debut. So I have to ask you, Alex, finally, give us a little tease about what you're working on next.
Oh, with great pleasure. So I skedaddled off the end of copy edits on The Housekeepers, which was a one book deal, and was like, oh my God, this wonderful opportunity is going to pass me by. I need to write another book immediately, which means on Monday morning, I started book two, which was way too soon. And I had sort of a desire in my mind to get the plan going and then write the first draft, and happy day, it will all happen again. And it was torture for about 2 months because the plan was a mess. The first draft was cold as anything. And I had to really go back to page one and just start slowly, slowly crafting again, and left all my good planning and disciplines behind and became a full-blown pantser. So we shall see what comes out of that process. But I have the first pass down of a new book that's a standalone set in the same world as The Housekeepers, but starring a fresh cast and a new dastardly scheme. So let us see how it goes.
That sounds so exciting. And I'm sure you're going to have the best time building your cast of characters again and kind of coming up with some new brilliant women, hopefully, and some maybe more bad men and all the in between kind of, you know, exciting characters that we'd expect to find in a heist. Well, I'm so looking forward to reading whatever you write next, Alex. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
I've loved it. I have to tell you very quickly before we go, I started listening to episode one when I think I was just sort of hoping and praying I would get an agent. And I can really remember the walk I was doing. It was at lunch. I had a sort of break from the sort of endless round of Zoom meetings. And listening to you was a real sort of motivator when I was just trying to see if I could make it over that finish line. And funnily enough, I did the same walk today just before we started chatting. And it felt like a really full circle moment. So thanks, so nice. Chloe, for the podcast. I'm a big fan, always have been. Really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, Alex. That's so nice to hear. Thank you. That was Alex Hay talking about his historical novel, The Housekeepers, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.